This weekend starts right after this.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News, This Weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Breaking conventional thinking in sports. I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Welcome into September. Here's what's coming up this hour. On the eve of the NFL season, a look at how the LA Rams went all in to get better this offseason by skipping long-term vision. Also, the revival involving Sears that has nothing to do with selling merchandise in its stores. Plus, innocent people with dirty-sounding last names who run into problems with filters when registering themselves online. And restaurants have a new way for you to relive your college years, an upscale shot with a more mature approach.
There are a lot of restaurants that are now offering interesting ways to take a shot in order to entice younger diners, kind of remind them of their college days. One restaurant offers a bone mousse, which is wine that's poured down the bone marrow after someone has eaten the actual fat out of the marrow.
Wall Street Journal contributor Alina Dizek on the classy way of doing a beer bong. She's here later in the hour. Well, President Trump, as you may have heard, thinks Google's search engine is rigged by featuring more mainstream news outlets and relatively fewer conservative sites. In the results he sees, Mr. Trump accuses the search giant of suppressing right-wing views on its platform. Tech analyst Rob Enderle, founder of the Enderle Group, is here to help explain in part how Google conducts its mysterious searches. Rob, give us some search basics.
I think one of the big basics is, you know, everybody's biased. So if you're not getting the news that you want to see, regardless of whether it's pulling the traffic, you're going to see see a result that's connected to that bias. And right now, the negative ink being generated around the president likely exceeds by some significant margin the positive ink surrounding his efforts. And that means that if you search on President Trump, chances are the top results you're going to see are from the major newsrooms and be negative, with Fox probably being the one stellar example on the other side. So it's going to look biased even if it's not. Now, Google's pretty circumspect about their algorithm. I do remember that Eric Schmidt, their then chairman and CEO, was closely connected to President Obama, and his effort, though clearly, if they'd planned to help Hillary Clinton, they were ineffective. But it is believed that they helped Obama significantly with his use of analytics and his success in his own election. So there is that connection, and there was also a lot of concern about how much they were helping that campaign on and off the record, because the company's leadership and the Obama administration was so close. So there is at least some smoke surrounding the concern that the president has raised, and I'm actually kind of surprised it took so long to go down this particular path, only because Google and Obama were so closely connected, and the president has been so, let's say, he hasn't been the most positive about the Obama administration. Leave it there.
Yeah. So what is actually going on here then?
It really comes down to the fact is even if it is unbiased, and let's be clear, developing an unbiased algorithm is virtually impossible until we get to a point where machines can develop it. And even then, if those machines were created with bias, that bias will pass through. So getting rid of bias once it's introduced is almost impossible, and because humans are biased and humans create these algorithms, the chance that this is biased is actually almost certain. It's just we don't know what the nature of the bias is unless you actually do some analysis and, say, run the Google search engine against others. I did do that during the Obama term, and it did look like it was favoring, when you compared it against Bing, it was favoring Obama more than Bing did. which could equally mean that Bing was biased as it would mean that Google was biased, but it was certainly an indicator that the two algorithms were working very differently.
I'm speaking with tech analyst Rob Enderle, talking about how Google does its searches since President Trump's accusation has brought this to the forefront. How might Google use artificial intelligence? And we're pretty sure it does, I guess, but how might it use it?
Well, what artificial intelligence does is it takes a look at a large amount of data and makes decisions, supposed to make decisions kind of like a human would make, going across the entire data set, and then gives you those results. And so it should make, in theory, it should give you much better answers.
How is what Google does forced media outlets to tinker with things for themselves to try to get better recognition, obviously, on Google?
Well, that's it. Part of the issue is for everybody now is to get clicks, and that means people that actually read and see the article, and so you see bizarre behavior. We call them clickbait headlines that have really nothing to do with the story. And so it gets people to go into the story, and they realize, well, now you're into it. It has nothing to do with what you saw. President Trump had relations with a goat or something, and you get in and you find out they're talking about a GTO Pontiac or something. It's really not related to what you thought you were going to read, and sadly that started to drift. That behavior started to drift over to news outlets, where a lot of times you'll see a headline and it really has nothing. It's inflammatory. It sounds really interesting, and then you read the article and not so much. So it really has forced the newspaper news organizations to do things that probably aren't that ethical in terms of presenting something that isn't what it really is. But they got to make money, and the people aren't clicking on the articles, they're not making any money. So there lies the difficulty. I think Google's done a pretty good job of reducing both the quality and the quantity of what we might call unbiased reporting. Largely because if you want clicks, you're going to appeal to somebody's bias, whether that be conservative or liberal or whatever. And that not only forces content, it forces how you structure and lead in that content. And so you really now it becomes far more difficult to make a delineation between real news and fake news, because there's so much arguably fake news now coming out of reputable media sites, only because they're altering their stories in some way, shape, or form to get clicks.
All right, thanks, Rob. It's tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the Enderle Group. It is 13 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. First weekend of September. A psychotherapist and grief expert says the deadly shootings at a video game tournament in Jacksonville, Florida last weekend is showing how we need better grief support. So says Megan Devine, also author of a book called It's Okay That You're Not Okay. She's based in Portland, Oregon. Megan, your initial reaction to these stories?
For me, the very first thing I think of when I hear these news stories is those poor families, right? They were having a perfectly ordinary day, and suddenly that world has vanished in an instant because of somebody else's choices, probably somebody they don't know, never knew at all. And it's that's where my mind goes, is somebody's world just evaporated, and what are they going to do, right? We're so ill-equipped to respond to grief, even sort of the normal end of a lifespan, grandparents in their 80s dying thing. We're as a culture, we're not really sure what to do with that sort of thing. And then you throw in this completely aberrant, atypical, violent death that came out of nowhere, and what are we supposed to do with that? What is the person who's surviving that supposed to do, as a direct friend or family member? But what are that person's support teams supposed to do? We're all just kind of horrified.
Yeah, there's a bullet point in your notes here which says our think positive culture contributes to our own personal sense of helplessness when faced with friend or family member's grief. Explain that.
Yeah. So the positive thinking culture is things like you pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Anything bad that happens is just to help you grow into a better, stronger person. That sort of thing. The put on a smile and it will change the world. Change your thoughts and think for a positive outcome and all things will go your way. That's what I mean when I'm talking about the positive thinking culture. There are places for that. Absolutely. Grief is not one of those places. Right, you can't look at somebody who's fiance or their brother was just gunned down in an outdoor mall and say, if you think about this better, you're actually going to see that it's going to work out for good and everybody's going to become stronger. Like, oh my gosh, what a terrible thing to say.
Yeah.
Right? But that's when we talk about hardship at all, it's usually sort of on that foundation of bad things happen to help you grow, and with the right attitude, things won't hurt so badly. And again, there are places for that, but grief is not one of those places.
We're speaking with Megan Devine, a psychotherapist and grief expert, and she's got a book out too. It's called It's Okay That You're Not Okay. And we're talking about dealing with the grief following the deadly shooting in Jacksonville, Florida at that gaming tournament. You said too, our society's tendency to judge grief damages relationships and stifles conversation. How?
So if you're sitting with somebody who's grieving and they're sad, right? Or they're talking about their person in what you think is like too much, excessively. And we kind of telegraph that judgment, right? You're doing this wrong. There's no right way to grieve. But again, what we said a minute ago was like the way our culture thinks about grief is just this little unfortunate blip that you have to work through quickly to get back to being sort of happy and productive. We can judge somebody else's grief against what we think we would do in that situation. One of the things that I'll say often to friends and family members who are trying to be supportive but really kind of missing the mark is, I hope you never have to know how wrong you are.
Ooh,
right?
Yeah.
Because the kind of hazing that happens for somebody whose life just went sideways, their person died, we get a really quick education in what it's like to be a grieving person. And suddenly all of those ways that we think about being supportive, you can really feel how painful they are. That judgment that we have about how somebody else is dealing with their grief, it's normal. I mean, humans make judgments. I'm not saying that we shouldn't judge. It's just like you want to question your judgments. And I hope you never, you know, if you're sitting there and you're saying like, oh, I mean, we saw this with the Parkland students, right? There was a lot of social media backlash that said, they're too angry, they're too sad. There was one post that came out where the kids were hanging out together and laughing, and there was backlash about that. Like, how dare they be laughing after they just saw their friends die? The judgment that we rush in with when we're uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what we're doing, right? Somebody else's pain makes us uncomfortable. It makes us feel helpless. It makes us butt up against the reality that random things can happen, and we don't like that.
Thanks, Megan. That is Megan Devine. Again, the book is called It's Okay That You're Not Okay. It's 22 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. The Los Angeles Rams did something radical this offseason. They acquired a bunch of really good players. Sounds so obvious that calling it radical sounds obtuse. A team with playoff aspirations went out and got players who will help them achieve that goal. But Wall Street Journal reporter Andrew Beaton says doing that also broke convention, not just in the NFL, but across a broader sports ecosystem that obsesses over long-term visions. Andrew, explain.
So they had a really fascinating offseason. They were obviously the surprise of the NFL season last year. They had a new young coach in Sean McVay, the worst offense in the NFL to having arguably the best. They went 11-5 and made the playoffs in a season that nobody expected them to. And this offseason, they really pushed their chips all in. They went out and did something that you don't see that often in football. They really went all in. They acquired four really good players, gave up a bunch of draft picks to get them. They got Brandon Cooks, star wide receiver. They got Marcus Peters, a cornerback from the Chiefs. They got Aqib Talib, another cornerback, giving them two very highly regarded players in the defensive backfield. And then they also signed Ndamukong Suh, who's been a real menace on defensive lines for a number of years now, and pairing him with Aaron Donald, who's the reigning defensive player of the year. And so the reason I think this is super unusual is we hear so much in sports these days about trust the process, or about a team's long-term vision, long-term plan. And in baseball, you see teams hoarding prospects these days and never trading them, or in NFL, the currency is typically in draft picks. And this is a team that said, you know, we have the opportunity to get a lot of really good players. We should do that.
But you have to have, I guess, like the Rams did, some sort of foundation, right? I mean, they had a great defensive player. They've got a quarterback who's now shown significant development. They've got what seems to be a star running back. That at least was there.
Absolutely. This is, definitely is not the NBA where one guy switching jerseys can totally alter the landscape of the entire league. Just look at Los Angeles. Everything changes in the NBA next season because LeBron James went there. But here, no NFL team has ever won itself, turned itself into a championship team by just signing a bunch of really good free agents. You're absolutely correct.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Andrew Beaton. He's written a piece entitled "The NFL Team That Went All In." You point out, too, how the Rams' approach inevitably raises long-term questions. Explain that.
Well, first of all, they had to trade a bunch of draft picks to get these guys. And they made some other moves where they recouped some of them, and they think that they'll get some compensatory picks in next year's draft from free agents who left them. But you're trading away draft picks. You traded away a first-rounder for Brandon Cooks. That was a big deal. And the issue beyond that is that eventually these guys are very good and need to get paid to long-term deals. So we've seen them give out deals to guys like Gurley this offseason. They signed Cooks to a new deal after they got him, but Aaron Donald, who's the star defensive player, is holding out for a second straight year while he waits for that deal. Eventually, a guy like Marcus Peters may need one. Eventually, Jared Goff, the quarterback, is going to probably require an expensive one. And usually, when the way to offset so many big long-term deals is by filling out your roster with young players. You do that through the draft. Well, they can't exactly do that because they've, at least to the extent that some other teams can, because they've traded away a number of their draft picks. So that's the predicament they face, but that's also a long-term question. Maybe they'll just let some players walk in free agency, but it's definitely something that fans will need to watch and what makes this year a really big deal in terms of, you can worry about all those things down the road. They have all these guys now.
Thanks, Andrew. It's Wall Street Journal reporter Andrew Beaton. 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. You don't often find the words business and friendly in the same sentence, let alone the same state. Unless, of course, you're talking about Michigan. Michigan's business-friendly practices help them become a leader in industries that range from agriculture and cybersecurity to aerospace and advanced manufacturing. In fact, Michigan is ranked among the top 10 states for major new and expanded facilities, which makes Michigan more than business-friendly. It makes Michigan business smart. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org. First full weekend in September. Thanks for joining us. I'm Gordon Deal. Coming up this half hour, are you always racking up credit card debt? Guess who might be to blame if, in fact, you're not taking full responsibility? Also, the classy way of doing a beer bong. Wall Street Journal looks at restaurants pushing upscale shots and innocent people with dirty-sounding last names and their problems with online registration. That story in about 20 minutes. It's time for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. If you want to take your business to the top, take it to a top 10 most improved state for business, Michigan. Contact MichiganBusiness.org today. Offices, luxury shopping centers, and large apartment buildings are a couple of the developments rising from the ashes of former Sears department stores. And New York Times reporter Michael Corkery says they represent an audacious feat of financial engineering by a group of wealthy investors who bet that one of the retailer's greatest assets was its real estate. Some say this engineering might not pass the smell test. Michael, what have you uncovered?
Anybody who's walked into a Sears recently knows just how bleak that company's situation is. I mean, they're closing dozens of stores every few months. The stores themselves are many of the shelves are empty. I mean, it's a really struggling retailer, and yet many of its former stores that about 3 years ago were spun off into a real estate company called Seritage are now creating a new fortune for the investors in that company. They're being turned into gleaming offices with views of the Pacific Ocean in California and, you know, very high-end retail developments in Connecticut with REIs and Whole Foods and Shake Shacks, apartments in Long Island. So Sears, at least its former stores, has a second life, it seems.
How about that? This was, what'd you say, a $2.7 billion infusion of cash with some of these properties?
right when this, when the deal was done and the stores, there was about 235 stores that were spun off from Sears into this company in 2015. The company Seritage then paid Sears $2.7 billion for the properties. You know, for Sears, a lot of that cash is gone. You know, the company said it made investments and tried to sort of find its footing, but it doesn't seem to have paid off. The retailer's still losing hundreds of millions a year. Meanwhile, Seritage is sitting on you know, several hundred great primely located properties across the U.S. and is turning them into all these different uses.
Hmm. What is the role here of Edward Lampert?
So Edward Lampert is a hedge fund manager. He plays a big role in both companies and a very unusual role in corporate America, Wall Street. I mean, this sort of, I don't think there's anyone like him in how he he's the chairman of Sears. He's Sears' largest shareholder. He's also the chairman of the real estate company, Seritage, and a very, very significant investor in Seritage. And so there's all these questions about when that deal was done, when these properties were spun off. Was it an arm's length transaction? Was it their conflicts of interest? Is his whole plan all along when he took over Sears as the largest shareholder, was his plan to basically strip this real estate out and kind of leave the retailer for dead? His response, or the response of his spokespeople, is no. He's in fact trying to keep Sears viable. He's just, you know, rejiggering it for the future, and meanwhile creating new value for a new set of shareholders with this real estate venture. But the questions are still quite alive, and many, many. If you just look at what's happened to Sears since then, you might come to a different conclusion.
Thanks, Michael. New York Times reporter Michael Corkery. 21 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for joining us. How do your parents feel about debt? The answer may have a lot to do with your own feelings about your current financial situation. That's because new research finds that parents pass on their anxiety levels around debt to their children. More from MarketWatch personal finance writer Maria LaMagna. Maria, what are we learning?
Probably not super surprising that people tend to track pretty closely with their parents in terms of how they feel about debt. So approximately the same number of people said their parents felt uncomfortable about debt as, you know, said that they themselves feel uncomfortable about debt. So it does seem to be something that sort of is taught in families.
Hmm. Pardon me for chuckling in a sexist way when I read the sentence that read, mothers and daughters were more uncomfortable with debt than sons and fathers. Meaning what here?
Yes, so women tended to say that they felt more uncomfortable with debt, and men answered slightly lower that they feel uncomfortable, and that's kind of consistent with other sort of financial surveys that we've seen. Men tend to be comfortable with a little bit greater risk, and women tend to be more conservative. They don't trade in their portfolios as often. So that wasn't super surprising to me, just given what else we know about how men and women manage money differently.
This is wrecking my stereotype, though, of women, the shoppers, racking up debt.
But right, right.
Perhaps they're not.
Yeah, and I think, you know, consumer debt is certainly part of it, but, you know, other major things like mortgages, student loans, that's all part of what they were asking about in the survey. So it wasn't just sort of credit card debt and that kind of thing. And so I do think women sometimes get a bad rap for going into debt when it may not really be the case.
That's interesting. All right, so the survey, did it cover, say, in some way, shape, or form, the recession? And has that changed people's thinking at all?
Right. I think it has. You know, since this was specifically looking at Swedish borrowers, it was mostly about, actually, in the country, they have eased standards for borrowing. So the government is actually giving more assistance for mortgages and for student loans. So they didn't, you know, quite see the same dip that the U.S. has seen. But, you know, I do know from previous stories that people now have fewer credit cards on average than they did in the past. And it does seem like we've learned some longer term lessons from the Great Recession, even though our debt levels, at least in terms of consumer debt, are pretty close to, if not the same as they were during the peak of the recession. So in some ways, you know, it's not looking so good, but We also have a bigger population now, so there's a lot of different things going on there, and it does seem like we at least learned how to be less delinquent on our debts and be a little bit more conservative.
We're speaking with MarketWatch personal finance reporter Maria LaMagna. Boy, when you talk about our debt currently, like, we use the T word a lot in terms of trillions.
Yes, right. That is true. Yeah, we have almost $1.5 trillion in student loan debt, more than $1 trillion in credit card debt. So, yeah, it's actually pretty shocking numbers. And, again, it's kind of hard to visualize that when it's across the whole population. But, you know, it's pretty real when you look at the averages per person. So, it's I think in the U.S. we are pretty comfortable with debt, whether that's a good thing and ends up paying off, like if you make a good investment in a home and, you know, end up cashing out later. But unfortunately, we've seen too many examples of when it goes wrong.
Yeah. And I mean, you point out too, to be fair here, if people are so afraid of debt that they don't invest in themselves, all right, well, then you perhaps have another set of financial problems.
Exactly. That's something that the research pointed out, that you know, sometimes you do have to take a little bit of a risk, and as long as that's a calculated risk and you really think it through, it can actually be a good thing. You don't want to have a whole population that's so afraid of debt that they are too afraid to invest in education and that kind of thing. So it's definitely a delicate balance.
Thanks, Maria. MarketWatch personal finance reporter Maria LaMagna in New York. It is 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Hey, glad you're with us. The lowbrow shot, long the mainstay of college drinking games and spring break, the one that occasionally turned us into a puddle back in the day, is being reinvented with a twist for grown-up diners. More from Wall Street Journal contributor Alina Dizek. Alina, set this up.
There are a lot of restaurants that are now offering interesting ways to take a shot in order to entice younger diners and kind of remind them of their college days, so to speak.
All right. So what's out there? Who's offering what?
One restaurant offers a bone mousse, which is wine that's poured down the bone marrow after someone has eaten the actual fat out of the marrow.
Wow, that sounds like it could get messy.
It could get messy. It's actually poured straight into your mouth, so people kind of take this as a shot and then continue on with their meal.
So it's just a shot of wine, that's what it is?
It's a shot of wine, and at some other restaurants, it's a shot of sherry.
Oh, wow. Very good. What else is out there?
There's another restaurant that's offering a duck jus and cognac pairing. So you can either sip a little bit of the duck broth and pair it with the cognac, or you can take both as a shot.
No kidding. What do they charge for something like that?
The price varies probably from around $8 to $15 for some of these shots. And some of the other shots are actually Jello shots that are offered, and a brunch place actually offers a breakfast shot that tastes like a morning latte.
Oh, my. And this stuff is like, it sounds like it's carefully paired.
Most of these drinks are carefully paired, and you know, just smaller portions of interesting cocktails and interesting pairings meant to complement the food.
What's the one with the breakfast tastes like a latte? What's in it?
The breakfast that tastes like a latte has hazelnut syrup in it and coffee infused whiskey. So I've heard it's really delicious, and people are getting it during their brunch.
Wow. We're speaking with Wall Street Journal contributor Alina Dizek. She's written a piece entitled "The Classy Way of Doing a Beer Bong." Restaurants push these wild and creative shots, upscale shots, as they're calling them. How widespread is this?
It's pretty widespread. It's in a lot of trendy restaurants across cities in the U.S., and people are really enjoying them. But for the restaurant, it makes business sense because it helps add to the check averages.
Man, and this is it's geared toward like which client? I guess you're trying to like reinvent your college days here to a certain extent.
It's in a way you're trying to reinvent your college days, but it's geared toward the Gen X or the millennial generation. That are, you know, there are people that are used to drinking, and they like to go out and enjoy themselves. So they're really trying to make this kind of a fun offering.
Thanks, Alina. Wall Street Journal contributor Alina Dizek. More on that story, by the way, the woman at the restaurant in West Hollywood who was having bucatini pasta with bone marrow, and she agreed to that specialty shot. The server brought a shot of Madeira, a Portuguese fortified wine, poured it over the bone marrow, and then yelled, "Bone luge," while banging on the wine bottle with a kitchen utensil loud enough for other diners to hear. 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. Sitting through roll call in school is already bad enough if you have a last name like Wiener, Butts, Cummings, and Medick. But try getting past the first stage of an online registration process. QZ.com says the internet-related woes of people with dirty-sounding last names are officially known as the Scunthorpe problem. The name Scunthorpe, for example, refers to the issues that residents of that English town have encountered with AOL and Google profanity filters because of the profane word contained within the name Scunthorpe. The latest innocent person, by the way, journalist Natalie Wiener, who noted on Twitter that she got an offensive language message when trying to register for a high school sports outlet. Cue the responses from others with similar problems. A man named Steve Sukunkok claimed to have the worst name possible for usernames. Philip Sporn had to set his name as Spron on his computer. This problem happens to Ben Schmuck all the time, he says, and the struggle is also real for Mike Dickman. That'll do it for this hour. I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Great news! There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.